before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that you can follow Chat Cemetery on Instagram and Twitter at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. You can also support the show on Patreon, where I will be releasing bonus content for this show and my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. You can support for as little as a dollar a month to get access to all of that content. You can also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Both are extremely helpful for the show, and now let's dive into today's episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by two members of the Podmortem, Travis Hunter and Renee Hunter-Vazquez. Today we are talking all about Dr. Sleep. Renee, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
And Travis, thank you for joining us for the first time.
Well, hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. I would like to note that Renee totally crashed this one, you know,
last minute. I apologize.
No, it's great. We love it. And you have done an episode on this movie already for your podcast, correct?
Yes, we have. I think back, what, last year?
Yeah, it was one of the early ones, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds about right. And you both loved it so much, you're back to talk about it on another podcast.
So nice we had to discuss it twice.
Precisely.
Yes.
It's too good to pass up. When I saw it on your list, I was like, we have to do this again.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those movies that I was not so sure about when I watched the theatrical version, because just going into it, not after the fact, but going into it, I was like, okay, I've heard things about this going into it. It's kind of like acting as a sequel, not only to The Shining book because of how King wrote Dr. Sleep, but also Kubrick's Shining movie. And that is a very, very tough balance to strike. I have some friends who don't like this at all. I have not disowned them. Don't worry. But for me, this really felt like Mike Flanagan was kind of pushed into a corner. And he was like, okay, I have to do what people are going to know who haven't read the books, and I have to do something for the people who have read the books. And, you know, Stephen King fans can be very particular about, you know, adaptations. I have to admit, sometimes I am too. I've watched many bad ones, many, many bad ones. But for this viewing, I watched the 3-hour director's cut. Is that what you both watched as well?
Yes, in fact, I've actually, ever since I've seen the director's cut, I have not gone back to the theatrical. I just feel like it is above and beyond. The theatrical was something I really liked, but then the director's cut, it made me genuinely love this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't seen the director's cut until I was preparing for today. And yeah, I've watched it twice, and I mean, that's saying a lot. That's 6 hours of Dr. Sleep. But yeah, there's no going back. I wish there was only this director's cut, because wow.
I bought the Blu-ray specifically because I knew there was the director's cut. I didn't know it was going to be on HBO Max later. But, you know, sometimes physical media is just nice. You know, it doesn't count against your internet data cap. So you're just like, yes, I have some more internet data that I can use for other things. But with this, I saw it in theaters and I hadn't rewatched it until I watched it for this podcast. I'm not huge on rewatching things simply because I feel like I have so many other things that I want to watch and, you know, read and everything like that. So for a lot of this podcast, I've been doing, you know, first watches, but some of them have been rewatches, because even though I knew Dr. Sleep was coming out and I was going to do it later for the podcast, I was like, okay, I'm not going to wait 2 years to watch this movie. I'm glad I saw the theatrical version first, but, you know, the director's cut, I think, definitely made this not necessarily better movie. It just felt, you know, maybe a little more cohesive in certain spots. For me, I rated them the same, which we'll get to at the end. But I want to dive into the cast. Renee, you might recognize one Bruce Greenwood making an appearance here.
Gerald himself.
And Carol Stroyken, who was, you know, big creepy man in Gerald's Game and also big creepy man in this.
Yes.
So many people who were familiar, especially within like the Mike Flanagan and King worlds, because then you have Henry Thomas as well. You know, once you are in Flanagan circle, you just stay there. You're good.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue. I'm just make myself comfortable here in the circle. That's fine with me.
I would be very happy to be in that circle. I think it's one of my favorite things when directors find their people and just keep using them over and over, because you know that the relationship is there. They know that the performances they're going to get out of them are going to be fantastic. It's just such a great thing to see over and over again.
Jacob Tremblay, too, has been in previous Flanagan stuff, if I'm not mistaken. So that is just a fun little thing. Same with Violet McGraw. You know, she was in Haunting of Hill House and some other stuff that I've seen her in for sure. But, you know, obviously the big names in this are Ewan McGregor, Rebecca Ferguson, and then you have Kylie Curran as Abra. And everyone else, you know, they're kind of character actors. You know, Cliff Curtis has been in a bunch of stuff. Zahn McLaren has been in stuff. Emily Allen Lind, that's a mouthful when you try to say it too fast. But for the two of you, and Travis, we can start with you. What was it about this cast that kind of drew you into these characters a little more?
For me, I felt like everybody played their part exceptionally well. Everything that was asked of them, nothing ever felt inorganic. Everything felt right and proper. I think my personal favorite that I have to give an absolute shout out to, I think she steals the show, is Rebecca Ferguson. Much like Flanagan had an unenviable task trying to marry these two worlds of Kubrick and King, I think she had an unenviable task as Rose the Hat when you look at The Shining and you have kind of not a necessary villain. I mean, you have the Overlook, you have the spirits there, you have Jack Torrance, kind of, and I guess alcoholism, mostly. Yeah. But when it comes to this, there is an honest to God, true to life villain. Rose the Hat is a villain. And it's so interesting to see that dynamic in this universe in conjunction with all the stuff coming back from The Shining. I just think that she absolutely blew me away.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. She really becomes Rose the Hat and makes her more, I mean, I'll say scarier and more like charismatic. And so those two together, it's just like you're drawn to her, but also you're like terrified of her. But Ewan McGregor, I think, does great. Even Kylie Curran as a child, it's like, wow, you know, she really stepped into that. My most honorable mention, though, is gonna have to go, you know, I love Rebecca Ferguson. Henry Thomas just left me wanting more. I was like, at first, is that Henry Thomas? I mean, I was just completely blown away.
Yeah, one of the things about this movie, too, is the fact that Flanagan had to recreate all of these characters in the Shining time period. And obviously these things happening 40 years apart, you know, King took a minute to write this sequel, took a minute. So the movies are also equally as far apart, pretty much. And for me, you know, it didn't bother me too much. I don't typically like shows that are doing reenactments when it comes to true crime stuff, because it just feels over the top and cheesy to me. And I was a little worried that this would end up being that for the Shining characters. But for the most part, it didn't bother me. They didn't look perfect, but they're not those people. So they're not going to, you know, unless you want to CGI their faces onto, you know, stand-ins, basically. But I think that would be a little unfair to the people like Carl Laemmle, who has been in so many things. And, you know, I think for some people, that is the thing that's going to be hit or miss, too. How did you feel about bringing those characters in that time period back?
I think he had a difficult choice to make, because it's either do a complete recast like he did, or attempt that weird digital, very, you know, uncanny valley, strange looking faces that distract you from the scene situation. And either choice that he made, I think he was going to irritate somebody. And so I think it's very bold that he did what he did. And I think it worked for me personally, because it never steeped into impressions or parody. It was very much stuck in the scene. I was thinking about one scene when Alex Esso as Wendy runs up to Danny, child Danny, and she sounds just like Shelley Duvall, but it's not her doing an impression of Shelley Duvall. And so it's mm-hmm. moments like that. And especially, I know you've already brought up Henry Thomas, but, and thankfully watching the director's cut, we get more Henry Thomas, which again, was very nice to see. And another character that I think made a huge return that I just can't believe how blown away I was by it is the Overlook Hotel itself. And seeing these rooms, seeing these hallways again, it was like seeing another character that you didn't realize how much you missed. I know Dan did not miss them, but I did.
I wanted to make the same point about Alex Esso's voice, because if you close your eyes, you can almost think that that's Shelley Duvall. And like you said, it's not an impression. So, I mean, it's not like, oh, she's the spitting image, you know, but it's like, it's there and it's not doing too much. And I think that anything from The Shining is not overused, because if there was like an excessive amount of flashbacks, I think it would be like, okay, well, can we, you know, see what Danny's doing now? But it's just enough to get you back in that frame of mind. And like you said, with the hotel, I can't even imagine how hard that was for them to recreate it, because it really feels like you're stepping right back in.
It really does. And the hotel for me has certainly always felt like a character too, between the books and all three movies. Well, one was TV miniseries, but we'll let it slide. And it has always had that sort of just evil aura about it. And you get so much more of that in this, because you see all of these ghosts coming out of the boxes in Danny's mind. You see the fact that it's taking over Danny the same way it took over Jack. And you have this knowledge from Danny that he can fight back against this hotel now. And obviously, we will get to the ending. But, you know, you just see throughout this how, especially in the director's cut, how much more time you kind of get with the characters. Because for me, I wasn't sitting there trying to remember exactly what was different from the theatrical version, since I haven't seen that one in 2 years. And I honestly just did not have the time or the energy to watch like the theatrical and then the director's cut right after it. But it mostly felt like extended scenes to me. Like we got more of a scene versus Flanagan putting in a bunch of new short scenes. You know, there were probably, I want to say, a few new things, but for the most part, it was just sort of continuations of what we had already seen.
I think that's a fair point. I did notice that there were some scenes that I could see some people deeming to be unnecessary. But I mean, one that comes to mind again is the piano playing scene with Abra. I don't believe that's in the theatrical cut, but I feel like it lays the groundwork for what we're about to see at the birthday party. Like things like that, all of these scenes that he's added, they serve a purpose. Nothing ever feels like, wow, this is going on a little too long. Can we get to the next scene? No, I just enjoy being there and seeing these character moments that weren't in the theatrical cut. And it just fleshes it out even more. Sometimes it even gives motivations or explains things that might have gone a little too quickly in the theatrical version. So they work very well for me.
I think as someone who read the book, if I hadn't, I think that the theatrical version may have left me confused as to what the True Knot is and who they are and what they're doing. But the added bits in that director's cut really explains everything. And I was very upset that there was that second bathroom Henry Thomas scene that was cut. I don't think I've been angrier in my life or more excited at the same time.
Seeing that red bathroom again, I just want to say it gave me life. But having them stage the blocking and frame the shot in the exact same way, these are the moments that I'm like, I think I love this film. Like there is... It's just pure cinema, and it just warms my heart so much.
It was a very nice balance for me personally. I was like, okay, you know, yes, part of this is fan service to people who love Kubrick's movie, which most people I know love Kubrick's Shining, even though it's not like the book, which is fine. You know, I think that is okay. And look, all of us here have read some Stephen King. He definitely puts in scenes that aren't necessary. We might know a book or two that goes on a little too long. And even though this was 3 hours, it didn't really feel like it, which I think is a plus, because there are some movies where you really feel the runtime. But if you even look at things like Shawshank and The Green Mile that are on the longer end, I didn't even realize those movies were that long when I went to go rewatch them. I was like, this is how long this is? Are you sure? Like, and that's kind of how this director's cut feels for me. And, you know, story-wise, they do a little more explaining of the true knot, like you were saying, Renee, and I think that works better. You spend a little more time with those characters as well. You are getting a little more of Abra at home. You're getting a little more of Dan, and it just made me like all of those characters more. And I have to go back to Travis's point about Rebecca Ferguson and Rose the Hat, because she's kind of one of my favorite King villains now.
Precisely. I could not agree more. I think there is just something so captivating about her performance and honestly alluring about the character. The way that she plays Rose the Hat, I know that Grandpa Flick is kind of seemingly, from what I understood, the founder of the True Knot.
Mm-hmm.
She might appear something of a protege of his, but she takes on a leadership role in the True Knot, and the way that she plays the character, it's so believable that people would line up behind her and follow her lead. I see a lot of villains that kind of just are there, and it's like almost your film is only as good as your villain. And if your villain is Rose the Hat, you've got yourself a fantastic film, because she just does so well in this role.
I think that even more egregious than villains just being there are villains that have this following and you're like, why is anybody listening to them? But Rose the Hat, it's very much, she's like, no, that's not my friend. That's my family. Like, this is a family. And you're like, okay, yeah, I'll follow you.
She went Fast and Furious on us. Yeah.
There's a little Vin Diesel in there, but there's almost like a culty aspect to it. But at the same time, I believe that she feels these things. It's not a matter of her being like, oh, I need these people around me so I can like kind of get off on the power of it. I think she actually appreciates each and every one of these people, and they are her family. I'm like, you know, psychic vampire or not, I might join the True Knot. I don't.
And you see how violently she reacts to their deaths too. Like, it physically hurts her. So it's like, she needs all of those people to be as strong as she is and to continue on. And, you know, why are King's best villains always killing children, though? That is my question. Why you gotta be like that?
I think we talked about in Gerald's Game how cruel he is to children most of the time. It's like, why, Steven?
It's usually an element of bullying. I think, like, Pennywise and Rose the Hat seem to take it to the next level, but it, for whatever reason, is just one of these things that he constantly uses, and it works. I don't understand, but I think this scene in this film with the baseball boy was probably the most difficult. Not saying that the kids in it didn't matter to me, but, and I barely even knew the baseball boy. But I was like, this is hard to watch.
Because it's so, I mean, he's literally being tortured, and it's just, they're just so like, yeah, no, this is what we got to do. Like, it makes it better for us. So, I mean, it was very hard to watch.
The preference of a tastier steam, I guess it's worth it to them.
I guess.
It purifies it, they say. And so, I mean, you got to risk it to get the biscuit, but that was pretty harsh.
It was. And you see how adamant Rose is about going after Abra, because Abra is the most powerful of the kids with the shine that they have come across. And, you know, there is something from the book that they did leave out in here that I was curious for both of your thoughts on. And it's when Abra's mom goes to leave, you know, to go see her mother, I'm guessing. And, you know, that whole thing is like this whole big scene in the book that has a big reveal and all of this stuff. So for you, was it okay that something like that, with the big reveal that Dan actually is Abra's uncle, isn't in the movie because she's already calling him Uncle Dan the whole time?
I think that's a fair point. I think it's kind of Flanagan's workaround to that plot reveal. Personally, I think that the film works better without that, because then it kind of also changes what we know of Jack Torrance, and you have to kind of piece together this timeline of how this is possible. And for me, I think it just works better that she's just like, you're my Uncle Dan because I call you that. And that's where it begins and that's where it ends.
I felt like it was definitely a nod to what was that big reveal in the novel. But I also am grateful, because to me it felt, I don't want to say a cop out, but it felt a little much. It's like, oh, we're connected in this way, but psych, no, we're actually like related. It's like, come on. It was a lot.
I think it works for me without it, because Dick Halloran didn't need to be related to Danny to care about him and to want to help him. To do that is just like kind of a hat on a hat. It's like, it's enough that they have the shine and they're connected that way. We don't have to make them actual relatives.
Yeah.
I think if Flanagan had inserted that scene, it would have, you know, messed with the flow of the movie a little bit. So I'm also glad it wasn't in there. And it was just like, in my head, I was like, oh, the mom's doing this thing that I know about all in my head. And even if you haven't read the book, you didn't really need to know that anyway, because like you both said, it kind of changes your perspective on what we already know, either from the Shining novel or the Kubrick movie or the McGarris miniseries, you know. So you have that moment in the book that I think, you know, maybe not necessary in the book either, to be honest, but, you know, I think this movie flows better without that. And that was just sort of one of the bigger omissions that I think stood out to me personally from, you know, book to adaptation. And obviously you have the fact that he's kind of playing to both sides of this. And, you know, story-wise, I think the director's cut does make this a little easier to follow, because of the added character work you get, the added information you get. So for both of you, did you have like favorite moments that just really stood out to you with this movie, or is it just you loved the whole thing?
It's difficult to pick a favorite. It's like picking your favorite child. I don't have children, but I imagine that's what it's like. But I think that for me, honestly, the last probably 40 minutes of the film, if I saw that on television, I would stop everything I was doing and sit down and watch those last 40 minutes. It is so good to me. And I think that's one point that I want to make, is while we are talking about a lot of revisiting of elements of The Shining, whether it's character work or the scenery, so to speak, I think that in these moments, even though they're literally at the Overlook Hotel, the film is still able to stand on its own with the story that it's telling, with Rose the Hat, with Abra, just happens to be happening in the Overlook Hotel to give these character moments to Dan. But it's just bringing it all together. And this is where you really get the marriage of Kubrick, King, and Flanagan. And I can't speak higher of those last 40 minutes.
Yeah, for me, that's definitely the best part of the film. My favorite moment being the scene in the bar with, you know, Danny and we'll say Lloyd. I also really, and I don't want this to sound weird, I didn't like the fact that Danny was visited by this woman and her baby that he really just left to, you know, fill in the blank. But that moment was so disturbing and upsetting. And I feel like Jack and Danny, it's like the cycle of addiction and abuse, because Jack hit his rock bottom and isolated his family away from everyone else. Danny hit his and found a community and found a place for him to get better. And just kind of watching him go from, you know, we see him at the lowest of the low, and even Dick is like, come on, man, like, this is what you're doing? To see him go from that to getting his chip and getting help and, you know, becoming Dr. Sleep and, you know, helping these people transition. It's just that whole story on its own. I would watch a movie of that. And then now we got psychic vampires and we're back at the over. Like, for me, it just gets better and better and better. But those last 40 minutes, just chef's kiss. I mean, it, and it is, I'm not gonna lie, it is fan service, like you said, but I mean, yeah, it's catering to me, so I'll allow it.
I think that's the distinction I had to make, is that I'm the fan that they're after. And that's fine. Like, I know that some people are probably like, wow, he's just stealing shots from Kubrick or whatever. Like, no, he's revisiting these moments because not only do they thematically matter, especially dealing with the cyclical nature of like everything in this film, they even call dying cycling, which was very interesting to me. But I feel like that those moments just not only encapsulate all the themes that they're working towards the whole film, but they are these payoffs for literally everything that you've seen before. I love it. I'm sorry.
And I mean, I feel like Danny is on the trajectory to follow the cycle of Jack, but in many ways he's Dick, you know, almost like a surrogate. That's his surrogate father. And that's who he comes into, and it, you don't get that at the beginning, but just watching that growth, and yeah, I'm a fangirl. I mean, I can't there's no denying it at this point.
Yeah, I really love Danny's character growth throughout this, especially when we see him as sort of the orderly, and you have the death cat, if you will. I don't remember the cat's name. But if the cat is on your bed, you dying. That's what that means. And just the small moments like that, like him talking to the patients and sort of just preparing them, essentially, and then they kind of just go to sleep. And when he is walking the hallway and the cat goes into a room and he's like, there's no one in there. And he goes in and, you know, you see this dark shadowy figure and then it's Dick. And you're like, okay, you know, Flanagan definitely did a lot of new things with this movie. It wasn't just, hey, we're going to, you know, take all of these kinds of shots that Kubrick did and recreate them. Sure, in the last 40 minutes, you get a lot more of that because we're back at the Overlook, but he did so much build up before that in, you know, the director's cut, the first 2 hours and 20 minutes, you know, this is a long movie. So to have that slow build, and then it just makes those last 40 minutes pay off so well. And I felt that way about the book too. You know, you have this sort of slow build and then you hit the climax and you're just like, okay, this is where everything is going to go down. We're going to have the big boss battle, you know, and you're going to have all of that. And visually, it worked for me. Renee, I have a very specific question for you. What is Mike Flanagan's deal with hands?
I have the same question. He's not a fan, clearly, because yikes.
This one wasn't as intense as the Gerald's Game one. But as soon as her hand was like shut in the file cabinet drawer, I was like, oh, I forgot about this one.
It's like, Mike, again? Again.
It's not a Flanagan film unless someone's hand
is degloved.
Absolutely messed up. Yeah.
And you see it later, like she has put the skin back on and it hasn't healed yet. So you could like tell where it's like all reattached. And I'm like, wow, you're just, at least you gave it back to Rose. You didn't, you know, for Jesse, but okay. Yeah. One of those deserved her hand way more than the other, let me tell you.
Definitely.
If we're stacking them against each other, I'd say yes, definitely.
So definitely some good gore moments in this too. And not every Stephen King movie necessarily needs to have those. I think there are very specific moments where it makes sense. Like when we see her hand caught in the file cabinet drawer and when they are, you know, eating the baseball boy, you get some pretty nasty moments there. But for the most part, it isn't a gore fest, you know, it's not like a zombie movie or a slasher or something like that. Even a lot of slashers aren't really gore fests, in my opinion, but that's a separate conversation. And, you know, the fact that there are so few of those moments, though, the way that Flanagan does them, they really just stick with you.
I'd say that's fair. I think it kind of also fits the tone of The Shining because there really wasn't much there to my recollection either. So it would be a little strange if he went the other way with it and it's just suddenly, no, in Dr. Sleep, we're going to chop people in half. And so you're like, no, that's not what we're doing here. It wouldn't make any sense. And so these moments where they actually do with Dan, whenever they're on the stairs with Rose the Hat and she nicks his femoral artery, these moments feel weightier because they aren't populating the entire film. So a scene like, and albeit the very extended scene with the baseball boy, it keeps you there the whole time. And what you're seeing grounds you in the reality of the horrors that they're, you know, perpetrating upon this boy. And so I think that all the choices made in that regard are servicing the film in the proper way.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if he had gone into it as some kind of Quentin Tarantino ultra violence, then that those moments would be like, oh, yeah, no, of course she, you know, chopped him with an axe. Of course they're murdering this child. It's like, no, we're so grounded. I don't want to say reality because we're talking about Shine and, you know, psychic vampires. But we're so grounded in that, that when those moments do happen, it's, you know, you're caught off guard because they're so visceral and so upsetting because, you know, we were just doing magic tricks at a birthday party, like, and here we are.
Yeah, as far as Rose's character development kind of goes, we pretty much know who she is from the beginning, so she doesn't have as far to go as someone like Dan does as far as character development. But I think, you know, the grocery store scene is sort of when that switch flips for her and she becomes more determined than she has ever been to get Abra, because Abra, you know, is in her head. She is thousands of miles away, 1500 miles, something like that. You know, she is not close. So the fact that Abra is able to do all of this as a, I'm guessing she's a teenager at this point, possibly a preteen. I'm bad with ages of children. I'm just like, I don't know. But that moment is kind of like, okay, Rose is putting everything she has into this, and she does.
To speak further to that, how shook she is when it comes to Abra, I think it's interesting that when we meet Snakebite Andy, she's like, oh, she's a pusher. We need her. We need her. We need to turn her. But when Crow's like, do we, you know, take the steam or should we keep her or should we turn her, and Rose is like, oh no, absolutely not, like, she's too strong, we can't be having that around here.
I do kind of want to amend a previous statement because I did say that she was not about using people, but Snakebite Andy, it does seem like they need her and so they bring her in for that reason. But when it comes to Abra, it is also kind of a power thing. She's like, if Abra comes in, she may or may not be after my crown, and we can't have that.
Yeah, she can't be stronger than me.
I also did want to point out that I feel like there's almost like an interesting character arc for Rose the Hat, even though we do get her villainous nature from the get-go. If you start with what she did to Violet, you're like, this woman is a monster. But then when you see how hurt she is by the death of her family, you almost feel a little sympathetic for her. Even though you know how horrible she is, that pain that she's going through, you understand her path to vengeance and what she's wanting from Abra and why she would go all this way and go to the Overlook like that. I just think it's interesting that when you have a villain, if you make their motivations clear and you understand their reasoning, they're much better for it.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And to go back to Andy real quick, you know, you have that moment in the woods, which is sort of the pre-boss battle, if you will. And you have people being lost on both sides. They didn't spend quite as much time on Abra coping with her dad's death, I think, as I would have liked. That's probably one of my main criticisms of the movie. It's not even really a criticism. It's just like, you know, they probably ran out of time for that. But, you know, the way that Billy goes, oof, that moment makes you hate Andy so much, because you kind of like her when we're first introduced to her. And you're like, okay, you know, she's just making men go to sleep and, you know, kind of ripping them off and whatnot. And it's sort of this more playful thing almost when we meet her. And then you see, as soon as they pick up Baseball Boy, you're like, oh, we're not going to like her at all.
I do wonder, because she does kind of start off as almost this unconventional Chris Hansen to catch a predator situation. And then as she gets more and more ingratiated into the True Knot, it's like, wow, did they awaken like her inner psychopath kind of a thing? Because with what happens to the baseball boy, she's pretty fresh to this group, yet she has no qualms about joining in on what they're doing. And so it's like, how quickly does this work? Or maybe that's just all about being a psychic vampire, which I know nothing about.
And being a hungry psychic vampire to boot, because they were trying to eat.
That is true. It wasn't about murder. It was about the steam.
Right.
Yeah, I get the rest of them being very, very hungry, but she was so new to this. I was like, why are you doing this to this boy? You can't be hungry yet. But she certainly just dives right in. And because we don't get any time with her, it's ambiguous as to whether or not this was sort of just dormant inside her. And, you know, having her turned is what sort of triggered it. I'm making an educated guess. That's what it is. And, you know, for me, just the way this was shot, the way the story plays out, especially in the director's cut, it just works so well for me. There are a few things that I wasn't a huge fan of. You know, you have the whole thing with Abra's dad that I mentioned, which Crow Daddy kills him because it's all a diversion. You know, they're like, wait, where's the main guy we were looking for? It's like, you didn't think to like take a head count when they all came out. And so their trick didn't work because he had a trick up his sleeve and her dad pays the price for it. And then her mom is just like nowhere and doesn't find out until like seemingly a day or two later when she gets back from her trip. That has to be one stinky house.
That's oh, yeah. True.
He did leave the door open, though. Maybe they got a breeze.
It's just common courtesy.
Some but ventilation.
But it's like, did none of the neighbors notice that the door was open and a dead guy was laying there? Or the timeline with that was a little unclear still, even with the director's cut. But because we're so focused on Dan and Abra and Rose, you kind of forget about that for a little bit, too. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, her dad's dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing isn't really revisited until the very, very, very end of the film. And you're like, oh, that's right. You kind of forget. But I feel like one good thing about the director's cut is you get that moment between her dad and Crow Daddy, which I don't think is in the theatrical, which is, again, very strange omission, because I feel like it's very important to see him try to get him away from his daughter. And to not have that in the film, it's like, well, what is, I think his name's David, what is David's arc then? Does he just rock up and get stabbed? What happened? And to have it answered, I think, is a good little addition.
Yeah, because you don't know in the theatrical one. They leave and then he's just on the ground. And it's like, oh, okay. I guess Abra's dad didn't make it. And all we get, you're right, is that one mention. Dan's like, sorry about your dad. And she's like, yeah, sorry about your friend. And then it's like, okay, now we're going to the Overlook.
And those are not equal. He barely, like, I know he's been friends with Billy for years now, probably 8 years, but his best friend is a huge loss. And I did love Billy as a character. I thought he was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Cliff
yeah.
Curtis did a great job. But Abra losing her father, I agree, Deanna. She should have at least shown a little bit more emotion regarding that, because it's very fresh. It just happened.
And she shows so much emotion when she finds out about Baseball Boy. So you're like, this seems a little off character-wise. You care about this random kid, which, you know, kid's dying. Nobody wants that. But then your dad, and you're just like, yeah, okay.
That's
I'll
a
be
very
down
fair
for dinner soon.
What? I didn't even think about that comparison until you brought it up. And now I'm thinking about it and just picturing her throwing the phone out the window. It's like, what is happening?
And I get they can't fit every single thing from a Stephen King book into an adaptation. You know, that is hard, especially when the books are longer and longer. You know, that's a big thing with it, especially even though it had two movies. It's like you still can't fit 1,100 pages into that. No. You can try. We don't need all 1,100 pages anyway. But, you know, with Dr. Sleep, I think the majority of the most important pieces were there. And that's why this ended up working really well for me. Are there any other specific moments either of you want to talk about? I just want to say I want a blackboard wall.
Definitely.
seems useful. It seems I might have to look into that.
Maybe more so a blackboard or a whiteboard, so you know, it erases a little easier and you don't have chalk all over your hands all the time, but you know, close enough.
I did have a couple things I wanted to bring up. One moment for me that really stood out is Rose the Hat's astral projection as she's like flying over the earth. And it's one of those moments that I'm very upset I did not see on a big screen, because I can only imagine how amazing that would have looked in a movie theater. But I did read that Flanagan spent months trying to get that to look right in post-production. And you can tell because it works perfectly. There's not a moment in that section that feels wrong or false or super CG or anything. It just works for me.
I also wanted to shout out the moment when Dan is talking to Bruce Greenwood in his office and how it's the exact, I mean, copy of Jack's interview with Ullman. And so again, it feels like it's like, Dan, don't, like, please don't make the same choices, same mistakes, but he just goes the other way with it. It's not, you know, going off to this evil hotel with a horrifying past. It's, you know, doing this really amazing thing for these people in this home. So it's just, that moment is just great for me.
I think that speaks to, because there's a scene again that was added in the director's cut where Halloran discusses with child Danny. He's like, look, you have more light in you, and the hotel brought that out. Your father had more dark in him. The hotel brought that out. But that doesn't mean that you have no dark and he has no light. We're all this living dichotomy. And so when you have this scene of Dan in the doctor's office and it's the exact replica of Jack's interview, you see that they're on the same but different paths, depending on the choices that they make. He's, like you said, going into this world where he's going to do some good. Jack is, you know, on a path towards basically destruction. But even in that scene, he's kind of acting like Jack, because if you rewatch the interview scene from The Shining, he is perfect with his answers. Every single answer. He's like the greatest interview I've ever seen. I might have to look into that for my next job interview, because his answers are just impeccable. But so are Dan's. Whenever he talks about, you know, he says, is hospice care, you know, something that you would, and he says that the world is basically like one big hospice with fresh air. It's like, that's a brilliant Jack Torrance answer.
It is. And it's just one of those mirror moments that we get, like murder showing up on that blackboard. And then, you know, you see it as red rum. And then even Danny stepping up to that door and us seeing him in that same exact view that we saw Jack. And it's just, he's being put in all these same situations that Jack was. But like you said, that the light, you know, prevails where Jack clearly was lacking.
I also love that moment when Abra is up against Dan and he's about to swing the axe like right at her face, and he stops. And I was just watching Chapel Wait, and a very similar thing happens in that. I don't want to give anything away for anyone who hasn't seen that one yet, but you know, it was just one of those moments where you have a kid who is inherently good, and she is piecing together very quickly that this is all the hotel. It's not Dan. It's not who Dan is. And that's something that Danny never had the chance to do because he was so much younger when he was at the Overlook. So the fact that Abra is old enough to really grasp what is going on, I think, is in favor of her character development too, because, you know, Danny was what, 5, 6, you know, he wasn't talking much. He didn't really know what was going on with his powers. Whereas with Abra now, she completely understands what's going on. And I think having that dynamic in this movie really works at the end. And I have to say, room 237 bathtub lady still looks creepy.
Some things never change. Yeah,
very much so.
Don't want to ever go in there.
No.
That's for sure. And, you know, she's just like hanging out in the background while this whole scene is going on. You know, she's in there.
just
hanging out.
I think that that's one thing that I do think is very interesting, is that when you take these spirits from the Overlook Hotel and you give them almost a different motivation with Rose the Hat whenever they're eating her steam, that's not something that was ever explored in The Shining. And you wonder if that's why whatever happened to Jack, could that have been a part of it? They sensed Danny's shine. I don't know. You know, I mean, it brings up all these other questions that, and I think that's something that a good sequel will do, is that it kind of makes you go back. Much like Dan, you return to the scene of the crime and you try to piece it all together and figure out how everything fits together. And that's one thing that I think they did really well here, is that there's this like very clear line thematically from one film to the other. And so when you do go back, it still makes sense. It doesn't ruin anything that came before. If anything, it enriches it.
Yeah. I also love that Dan had the boxes in his head and they were just all in there, because he was never going to be able to fully escape them. He just had to contain them. And because Rose was sort of the immediate threat, you know, they go for her first, but then they instantly turn on Dan and he's just like, oh yeah, what did I do? So his option is the boiler room, which my question is this: did they just rebuild the whole hotel, or am I making stuff up?
From what I read anyway, they talked to both Stephen King and the Kubrick estate, and they got blueprints from the Kubrick estate to rebuild these sets almost to exact specifications of the Overlook when they built it the first time. So I think that's how you're able to get lost in the Overlook again, almost as if they're revisiting old sets that you know had to have been destroyed in the past 40 years. Yeah. So I think that that's how we're able to have these moments where you're actually getting these feelings of deja vu, because they... Hats off to the production design, because they really went that extra mile to make you feel like you are returning to this place.
But am I crazy, or didn't it blow up in The Shining?
Oh, is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Not, my bad.
Both.
I went all cast and crew, yeah.
In the novel and in the miniseries?
I believe,
but in Kubrick's, no.
Yeah, in Kubrick's, okay. It still stands.
I knew it blew up somewhere. I was like, there's too many options.
It blew up more times than it didn't blow up, in right. Your defense.
Look, I've read and watched a lot of things. The Shining was a long time ago at this point. Mm-hmm. Both the book and the movie. The miniseries happened somewhere in between. But yeah, so I was like, okay, it didn't blow up in one of the stories, one of the versions, because it's still here. And then now it has blown up. So, you know, that is Dan's way of making his peace with it, essentially. And unfortunately, it costs him his life, which they try to trick you a little when you see him later, because I didn't believe he was in Abra's room. But it just felt like, oh, okay, they're just communicating again like they usually do. And you're like, wait, no, you're dead. You didn't get out of there with that femoral artery bleeding everywhere.
But that moment of him, and then you pan over and then it's Wendy, and then you pan over again and it's, you know, Danny as a little boy. I'm like, is there something in my eye? Because it's a lot.
I think there's just something, if I were to describe Mike Flanagan's work with one word, I think it would be sincerity, because you go to Haunting of Hill House, you go to Haunting of Bly Manor, any of his other films, especially Dr. Sleep, you feel the emotions that he's putting his whole heart into these films. And when you see a moment like that, and the moment with Charlie, when Dan is acting as Dr. Sleep and they're singing together, mm-hmm. and the camera just pulls back, my eyes got a little salty.
I was like, why am I crying?
Yeah.
This is a horror film.
Yeah. And I love that moment after Abra talks to Dan, where her mom comes up and she's like, who are you talking to? And she's like, oh, no one. And then she gives it a second thought and she's like, okay, no, I was talking to Dan. And she's like, you know, him and dad are fine. And that's kind of the last mention we get of her dad. And then it's just like dinner time. And I'm like, you know, that's fine. Not everything's going to get wrapped up. Have you read Stephen King? I mean, we're good. Gotta leave some things just in case you want to revisit them 40 years later.
There you go.
But is there anything else before we dive into ratings? It seems like for the most part, all three of us are on the same page here. And I think I brought up all of the scenes I wanted to mention, this was a long movie, so I may have missed one or two things.
I think just one thing I wanted to mention very quickly, again, about Mike Flanagan, is you can tell that he is such a fan of Stephen King's work. Because there are so many references, I know specifically to The Dark Tower in this film, and the line that Dan says at the end, there are people like you, people who stand. There's these moments that only could come from somebody who is just very much in love with the work of Stephen King to plant these into these moments where they probably weren't normally. I doubt there were a lot of Dark Tower references in the Dr. Sleep novel, yet there's the Tet Transit and what, Lemurk Industries.
Yep.
So I just really appreciate his devotion to almost building his own little Stephen King universe every time he seems to adapt Stephen King.
One final question for both of you. Do you think we will see the True Knot again in future Stephen King books, however many he has left in him?
I feel like they're too good and too mysterious for us to not see again in some way, shape, or form.
I would definitely agree. Even if it's small little things, like I know in Dreamcatcher where they had, what was the Pennywise Lives graffiti? I think there could be a little like Rose the Hat, even if it's just like a hat with a rose on it, somebody painted somewhere. There's going to be something. There's no way you can have these characters and never revisit them again. I think, at least in my opinion.
Well, and if Rose was telling the truth, there's more out there. I mean, who knows if she was, but...
Yeah, she wasn't the best person.
I don't think she's above a lie or two.
Mm-mm.
Certainly not. But I do hope we get to see them again, too. Whether it's like a short story, kind of like how King gave us Jerusalem's Lot with Salem's Lot. And, you know, obviously he loves this story and Dan as a character and the Overlook, because if he didn't, I don't think he would have revisited it like 40 years later, I think is roughly the time between the books, if not exactly at the time between the books, actually. So I never put it past King to revisit things, because when he falls in love with characters, we see them over and over and over again. You see, you know, Holly Gibney in the three Bill Hodges books, and then in The Outsider, and then in her own story, and If It Bleeds. So clearly, when he gets attached, and you definitely see more. So I'll be very curious to see if we see more of the True Knot, because it really did feel like he loved Rose the Hat as a character.
Yeah, no, as he should. She's great. I mean, she's awful, but she's great.
And she's seen a lot of things. Like, she's gone through a lot of time periods. So you very easily could go back in time and say, hey, what was it like when Rose was turned? And write a story about that. And I'd read it gladly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm obligated to. I signed an invisible contract, apparently. But I also just want to quickly say, you know, the score for me, I think... It wasn't that it was bad, you know, it was definitely like, this is how you should feel right now. And, you know, I still really like it, though. Like, one thing I had been doing when I was reading the Stephen King novels was I would put on soundtracks while I was reading. So I'd have like Halloween, Jaws, Jurassic Park. And then I was like, all right, we're going to get some Dr. Sleep in here. We're going to get some of the recent stuff. And it's just one of those things where if I notice it, then I'm like, oh, I don't think I wanted to notice this. But here, it's still subtle enough to where I'm like, okay, I see what you're doing with the score, but it's not distracting me too much.
I think that's a very fair point. And I think that's one of the things that Nay and I have talked about is enjoying the work of the Newton brothers with Mike Flanagan. I do feel like the Dr. Sleep score, I can't say that I don't like it because I really do like it. I think the thing for me is that I can't separate the amount of fan service they put in there with the Dies Irae and everything. For me, that's a plus. I love them revisiting the original score so often in this new score, but I can see how people would kind of get annoyed by it possibly. But for me, it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a win for me too, because it's just so striking. The minute you hear it, you're like, oh, like we're about to be in for it.
That's very fair. Well, if there's nothing else, let's move on to some ratings. For me, I gave this a 4 out of 5 both times. It held up. You know, I know, Renee, I mentioned this when we were talking Gerald's Game. the hand scene, I couldn't remember, you know, if it was going to hold up. This hand scene also mostly holds up. So the fact that you don't have so many of those moments where you're worried whether or not they're going to hold up also helps, because so many of the moments in this are just character moments. And, you know, I am going to go through and do a massive rankings list because I have lost my mind completely. So I'm going to have one for the adaptations and I'm going to have one for the novels and collections and everything. And I have like three sets of criteria for each list. So, you know, Renee, you and I discussed that Gerald's Game, great movie, not super rewatchable. I think it's safe to say this one is definitely more rewatchable.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like I said, I've watched it twice in the last 2 days. I mean, having said that, I'm probably good for a while, but yeah, it's not as emotionally just grueling as Gerald's Game was.
What would you rate this one then?
It is a Stephen King adaptation that is a continuation of The Shining, directed by Mike Flanagan. So, I mean, everybody set your faces to stunned, but on Letterboxd, I did give this a 5 out of 5.
Whenever I saw the theatrical version on Letterboxd, they gave it a 4.5 out of 5. Having seen the director's cut, and knowing just how difficult the task was for Mike Flanagan to put all of these things together and do it in such a way that not only does it work, but it excels in everything it's trying to do. Like Nay said, it's Kubrick, King, Flanagan all just rolled into one. And I had no choice but to give Dr. Sleep a 5 out of 5. I watched yesterday a double feature of The Shining and Dr. Sleep. Then this morning I watched Dr. Sleep again, and I might watch it again tomorrow. I love it. It's just so good. Part of why I chose it whenever you sent me your list of films to cover in the future, I was like, Dr. Sleep, got it. I got to put my name here because it is just that film for me. I love this so much.
Yeah, there have been a couple of recent films that are like that, where when I sent this spreadsheet out, like everyone was putting their names down for Dr. Sleep and It. And I was like, oh, what have I done? And, you know, I got the list all worked out. So everyone was getting at least one episode there. But yeah, this one, definitely a good rewatch. I love the dedication that you both have to this episode because you both watched it more than I did. That's for sure. I really appreciate that.
Happy to do it, honestly.
We try to
come
prepared.
Doing the work for me. But thank you both so much for coming on. I know the rest of the list is pretty much covered through 2022 here, which I believe will be coming up soon by the time everyone hears this. I've lost all sense of time. I don't know. But I'm sure I will have both of you back on at some point for some other King topic. So thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, definitely. We'd happily come back.
Absolutely.